And welcome to Monday's Topical Currents. Good afternoon to you. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is on vacation. And today we visit with renowned psychologist and professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire, John D. Mayer. He's a pioneer in the field of personality psychology, and he co-authored the influential article Emotional Intelligence with Peter Salovey. He's the current president of Yale, which created a revolution in the way we think about intelligence. His latest book, his first for a general audience, is Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives. And John D. Mayer joins us, well, I guess, from the University of New Hampshire in Durham. Is that where you're still from? Okay. All right. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you made it.
me as well.
Yeah. Okay. So there's so many different kinds of intelligence, but I thought we'd best begin with a definition of intelligence.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are, as with any academic field, there can be disagreements about the definition of intelligence. But one area where there's a fair degree of consensus is that intelligence involves the capacity to reason accurately, to engage accurately in abstract thinking about the world. By abstract thinking, I mean to see similarities and differences in things, to recognize patterns, and to carry out thought accurately.
Okay. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to go back to 1990 when you co-authored this groundbreaking article on emotional intelligence.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd like, for those who are unfamiliar with it, could you just give us the background of what led to that, I guess it was a revelation in 1990?
Yes, well, at that time I was working with my dear colleague, Peter Salovey, who, as you've already noted, is the actually now president of Yale University. And Peter and I actually started work on that project in about 1988. And if I could, I would lay out for you sort of the geography of intelligence research at that time, which is different than today.
Okay, yeah, please do.
At that time, most psychologists in practice were measuring two different intelligences. What they called a verbal intelligence, which was the ability to understand words and sentences and how those went together to communicate things, and a perceptual organizational intelligence, which was the ability to do things like put together puzzles or to see how different designs fit together to make a new design. And these two intelligences were part of a broader general intelligence. And that was probably the layout of intelligences that most people were familiar with in 1988. A couple years later, there was sort of a new consensus, which added in a few more intelligences, like spatial intelligence, which, although it sounds similar to perceptual organizational, is a bit different and involves rotating objects in space. And so there were these sort of broad intelligences, the verbal intelligence, perceptual, organizational, and spatial. And at about that time, in the time leading up to that, Peter and I were both involved in research on how emotions changed thinking, an area in psychology then referred to as cognition and affect. And we began to wonder together, well, what could it be that there's some adaptive purpose for emotions changing thinking, that there's some adaptive interrelation between intelligence and emotions. And from that idea, we thought about, could there be an intelligence about emotions which would be markedly different than the ones that existed at that time?
Okay, so what is emotional intelligence? Assuming that it means it gives us the capacity to reason, is it the capacity to reason about emotions?
It is the capacity to reason about emotions. So, for example, if I say Jane was angry and an hour later Jane was ashamed, it means knowing that in between she probably did something like explode at somebody and then discovered she was wrong to do so, or simply was embarrassed to have lost her temper. So knowing that she was angry to begin with and ashamed later, you can map out a series of steps that lead her from one to the other. That would be an example of an emotional intelligence problem.
Okay.
And initially in our theory, we also thought that emotions can also enhance thinking, but that's been the more complex part of the theory, and it's been less borne out by research, I think, than the reasoning about emotions, which is fairly secure at this point.
Okay. So the fact of it not necessarily enhancing thinking, that's what you're saying has not been borne out by studies?
Yeah, I still think it's there, but it's very tricky to measure. And one of the decisions that I made with Peter early on was that we weren't going to be just theorists. We were going to try to demonstrate that this intelligence, and later I made the same decision with personal intelligence, the intelligence about personalities, that we really wanted to demonstrate that these intelligences existed to a point where it would be impressive to other intelligence researchers, and they would need to take it into account in their models.
Okay, is that this MSCEIT, the Mayer Salovey Caruso Emotional Intelligence Test, is that what you developed in order to measure it?
Yes, that was actually the third or fourth generation of a number of scales that we developed, all involving reasoning about emotions. And what we were able to show over those scales was that people who are good at reasoning about emotions in one area, one kind of emotion problem, like the Jane is angry and then Jane is ashamed problem, are also good at solving problems about emotions in other areas as well, like what's the best way to make somebody else feel happy in a specific situation. And so through those tests, we were able to show that people vary in their abilities to solve these problems, and that it's a somewhat broad problem-solving area that they have to engage in.
Now, why do you think that, I know we're going to get to personal intelligence.
No, it's fine.
But why do you think this idea of emotional intelligence became so popular?
Well, part of that was not entirely our doing. In fact, after we published our 1990 article, scientists measure how much influence they have in a field in part by how many times their articles are cited by other researchers. And I would say from 1990 to 1994 or so, our article had been cited maybe once or twice, and at least half of those were by us. We were not attracting a great deal of attention to our research. But in 1995, a New York Times journalist named Daniel Goleman was working on a book, and he saw our research and wanted to communicate that to the public. And he gave his book the same title as our article, Emotional Intelligence, and that became that really excited people and got them very, very interested in the topic.
And why do you think that was?
Well, Dan is an excellent writer, and I think the book was a great read. And then I think also there was a lot of resistance within psychology and within intelligence, among intelligence researchers, to believe that there could possibly be an intelligence about emotions. In fact, there have been a number of psychologists and intelligence researchers who are psychologists typically, intelligence researchers who had suggested that there were additional intelligences. But historically, they hadn't really gone to the trouble of demonstrating it. And so I think the expectation in the field was, here's another couple of guys, they've postulated an intelligence, no need to pay attention until there's some empirical data, and there probably won't be any.
Mm.
So when Dan, when our article came out and Dan's article came and Dan's book came out, we were already well underway to collecting that data.
All right. Well, we are going to move on to personal intelligence, but we need to take a break. We're speaking with John D. Mayer. He's a professor of psychology at the University of New Hampshire and a renowned psychologist. And his latest book, he's written tons of articles and psychological tests and books, but this is his latest, Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives. Let's take that short break, and we'll be back. And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. We're speaking with Professor John D. Mayer of the University of New Hampshire and a renowned psychologist whose latest work is Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality, and How It Shapes Our Lives. So moving on from there, do you want me to call you Professor?
Jack is fine, or John is fine.
Jack, okay, that's right. You like to be called Jack. So how did this work with emotional intelligence lead to this current work with personal intelligence? Is there a direct link?
There are several indirect links, I would say. Well, first, it did create a template for how to propose and then measure an intelligence that I was grateful to have. But there was a second less direct link, which was when that popularization or journalistic account of our research was created, there were a number of journalists stepped in and said, well, what is this emotional intelligence? And they often ascribed to it qualities that Peter and I had never anticipated, nor really should have anticipated, would be a part of it. So mixed in with emotional intelligence were all these personality-related attributes like optimism and good character and motivation. And we would hear these things, and Peter and I knew, well, our theory doesn't deal with those. That's an error to believe that those are part of emotional intelligence. They're simply not. But it was very frustrating for me because I am a personality psychologist, and I was going, oh, it would be so great to have an intelligence about personality, but there's just no way to do it right now. This was back in 1990. You see, when Peter and I came up with emotional intelligence, we had the benefit of a dozen or more really profoundly brilliant emotion researchers who had worked out the rules of emotions leading up to the or collated the rules of emotions leading up to our 1990 paper.
Okay.
So we knew what the right answers about emotions were at that time. And as a personality psychologist, I knew that back in 1990, the field of personality psychology was in no shape to produce rules of personality, rules by which people act and rules by which we can understand people. There was no way to do an intelligence like that at that time. But if we fast forward to 2005, 2006, 2007, the field of personality psychology had matured tremendously. There was an enormous amount more known about personality. And so it became possible, in principle at least, to begin to think about, well, yeah, if we start asking questions about personality, what those questions are that people use to understand one another and what the right answers are as well.
So that's how you were able to now determine that we do have a personal intelligence and be able to measure it.
Yes, well, that was the period of time when I first germinated the theory and wrote out the theory in a way that where I felt had confidence that it could be tested, although I had no particular confidence that such an intelligence would exist. The thing that gave me the greatest hope was a growing discussion among evolutionary psychologists that human beings must have developed some way of anticipating one another's behaviors and that that would have provided an adaptive advantage to people. So there was this sort of evolutionary argument that people ought to possess a capacity to reason about one another. And that gave me hope. But when I thought about the diverse kinds of problem solving necessary to understand personality, I really had my doubts as to whether such an intelligence might exist. And in fact, when I called up colleagues of mine to help me think through and start to test and research this idea, I had to say to them, look, it's a little bit of a flyer, but you know, let's give it a shot for a year or two and see if there's anything there.
So how long have you been working on this? You've been working on this since 1990 as well?
Well, I guess you could say I've been thinking about it for a long while. But the first theory, the first statement of our theory of the theory came out in 2008, and then from 2008 forward, I wrote a second theoretical article refining the first and talking about potential ways to measure personal intelligence, and then in 2012, with my colleagues Abigail Panter of the University of North Carolina and David R. Caruso of Yale University published an article that demonstrated that this area of problem solving about personality actually exists.
So in an effort to keep everything as clear as possible, which I'm trying to do because it's a little complicated.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, please don't be. You're doing great. I'm just trying to keep it straight for myself. How is personality defined?
Okay. So personality is really cool as I see it, because personality is kind of like an orchestra, like the orchestration of everything that a person is. So in fact, you can think of a parallel to an orchestra with its woodwinds and string sections and percussion instruments and perhaps a keyboard or two. And in the same way, personality is composed of its motivation section and its emotions section and its cognitive sections and its self-control and its outward expressions. And so I think of personality in a way as an inner orchestra that plays the music of our lives. It is our way of being. And so it's a broadening of emotional intelligence past emotions to all these other systems and how they and their interplay together.
But it can be influenced, our personality, by so many different things at any given moment. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And that's one of the reasons why people were very skeptical, and I was skeptical, could there possibly be a personal intelligence? In fact, for through much of the 1990s, and certainly before that, in the 70s and 80s, many psychologists believed that personality was a rather inconsequential system, that all of our behavior is influenced by situations. And you can see that, I mean, just as you and I are talking right now, we're in a situation of an interview program on a radio station, and I'm behaving in ways that are quite, and probably you are behaving in ways that are quite different from the ways that we might behave once we're not doing this program any longer. This is a strong situation which dictates that certain parameters of our behavior, that you'll ask me questions, that you'll take station breaks, that I'll answer questions as best I can, and so forth.
Right. So it is so subject to so many forces at any given time. I found this study that was conducted by Bertram Forer.
Yes.
Very interesting, because it talks about more the similarities than our differences, even though there's so much that says we're each different. But would you tell us about that study?
Yes, I'd love to. That study, the Forer study, is actually one which I was turning over and over and over again in my mind for a long time, and really was germinal in this coming up with a theory. In brief, Forer was an instructor in the Los Angeles area, and he had a group of psychology students, or students in his class, wanted to take a test of personality. So he said, okay. And a week or so later, he brought in a test of personality, gave it to all the students, and said, okay, next week I'll bring you in your scores. So next week he brought in the scores, gave them out to the students, and he had the students look at how their personalities were described by the test, and evaluate whether they had gotten an accurate self-description. And most of the students said it was either a very good 4 and a 5 point scale or an excellent description of themselves. But there was a little wrinkle in this, and Forer asked one student in the class, could you please read your self-description? And he stood up and he read his self-description, which started out something like, you, in public, you seem to have a lot of confidence, but inside you have a certain number of personal doubts. And you're hoping to attain more in life than your parents did, and a few other such things. And as he began, the other students in the class first looked rather uncomfortable, and then they started to laugh as each of them realized that they had all received the same exact feedback, and they had been unable to tell apart that what was written for them was written generically. So what does this mean?
Yes.
Well, a lot of people who don't think personality is consequential concluded from this that people are suckers about their personalities, and in fact, there's not much to personality at all. And you can see why this would trouble me as a personality psychologist,
right.
Interpretation of it. In fact, it became known as the Barnum effect after the expression, there's a sucker born every minute. but there's another interpretation of it, which I think is more valid. Where Bert, first of all, Forer had gotten his descriptions from astrological writings, from astrologists. And I think that one way that astrologists do business is they find these lovely descriptions of personality, which are near universal. And so it wasn't like a random set of descriptions. It was a set of descriptions that really describe a lot of people very well. And in fact, if you repeat the study, which has been done, and you provide real feedback, individualized feedback to people, people can tell the difference between the individualized feedback and the generic feedback, although not terribly well, which raises, in my mind, the idea of, well, maybe some people can do it better than others. And those are the people who I think have high personal intelligence.
That they can tell the difference between themselves and others.
That they know both
how they're alike and how
quality, yeah, how they are alike. Thank you. Yes,
sorry.
How they are alike how they are like others, and also how they are different from others.
You know, there are so many disciplines, spiritual, I'm thinking, that tell us that we are each unique. Do you think this is untrue?
We are each unique, I think, in absolute terms. There are differences among all of us, but there are also enormous numbers of similarities, which enable us to empathize with others and understand how other people are feeling, and to read others' personalities with an idea of how to anticipate them.
So you say that part of the way to be accurate about ourselves is to assume that we're similar to others until it's pointed out to us that we're not?
Yeah, or until we figure out that we're not, whether somebody points it out or not. There are a variety of different ways that we take in information about ourselves. So one way is to have people point out those differences to us. Another is by introspecting, which has its limits, but in some areas has strengths. So part of learning about ourselves and our identity is that discovery process of how we are the same, but also how we vary in certain significant ways.
I just want to point out that we're having a fire drill the station right now. And so there are a lot of bells going off, if that's what you're hearing. And I'm assuming it's just a drill. We think, right?
Okay. Hope so.
I hope so, too. So let's take a break and see what we can find out about this fire drill. We're hoping. We're speaking with John D. Mayer, professor of psychology, University of New Hampshire, and the author.
Hold on here.
Okay, yes, you stay there. The author of Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality, and How It Shapes Our Lives. We'll be right back. Well, we are back with today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. We're visiting with Professor John D. Mayer, who's a renowned psychologist and the author of Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality, and How It Shapes Our Lives. And I'm wondering about my own personality, that and how this is affecting this interview with this fire alarm going off in the background. Okay, are you still with us, Jack?
I am, and do we know you're okay? You're all okay there?
It looks like we're okay. It looks like it's just a drill, and they're trying to get it turned off.
Oh, good.
Okay, so what occurs to me is, in order for this to work, I would think, we would have to know about ourselves. So I'm thinking about those who think they know themselves but really don't, either because they have blind spots, which so many people, if not everyone, does, or perhaps they deceive themselves, or they see themselves entirely differently than others see them. So how does that affect this equation?
Yeah, I think that, well, I think that's where the intelligence part comes in, because we each are going to have our own route to understanding ourselves and other people. There's no manual that you're given or your parents are given when you're born that says, okay, this is this child's personality, so all you have to do is open it up and study it. We have to figure that out. And one of the things that attracts me to the intelligences is that they are, they're the ways that we figure things out, they're the ways we get things done, including creating sufficient knowledge about ourselves and other people to operate. So, for example, if we are smart about this, we know that if we hear something that sounds odd about ourselves, for example, maybe somebody tells me, you know, you're kind of controlling. And I listen to that and I go, oh, no, I couldn't possibly be controlling. My intention is not to control other people. That's one thing. But if I hear that and then a year later somebody else tells me, you know, you're really kind of controlling, and I go, that's interesting. That's the second time I've heard that. And then I hear it a third time, I might go, well, you know, maybe I am on the, you know, maybe I am kind of controlling. What does that mean? And am I happy with that or not? You know, would I like to change that? And so that's, so looking for repeated feedback from different parties, independent sources, is one way that we can build that information up. And if we're clever about it, we recognize that that's one way that we learn about ourselves, even if we don't like it. Because we have to be able to be open to it, and indeed, if we just hear it once, we might be right in disregarding it. But if we start hearing it multiple times, we're going to have to pay a little bit more attention. But the problem is that if you don't have this, if you're not so good at puzzling this out, then feedback becomes really an unknown to you. It's the only way that you have to respond to it is that you like good feedback and you don't like bad feedback. And it's really rather mysterious what information to you, if you're not clever about figuring out when the information is correct or not. You may get confused as to what's reasonable to hear and what's not, which is, I think, why some people become defensive. It may not be that they're unwilling to take in negative information about themselves. It's just they're very confused about when it's accurate and when it's not.
Well, because you're dealing with other people, so other people can project.
That's right.
They can transfer.
Yep.
So.
And they may just not be out for your best interest.
Or they may just want to, exactly.
Right. They may say, don't apply for that job. Well, maybe because they want it.
Right.
You know, you don't have those right skills for it. Or something like that. Those are legitimate. Hopefully, people don't do that, but they do it on occasion. And it would be naive to think otherwise. So, how do we know if we really lack the skill, and it's accurate feedback or not?
Or how do we know if we're controlling or they're just projecting?
Right. That's right. The example I give in my personality class are the two people who yell at one another that they're both stubborn,
and they both are.
Right. Yeah. How do you figure that out? Well, in that context, they're both stubborn, but who knows?
We're speaking with Professor John D. Mayer. He's a renowned psychologist, and his latest book is Personal Intelligence: The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives. Do you think you have a high or a low personal intelligence? And we're going to look at the hallmarks of that. But you can call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. So skipping to that, I have a lot more questions about it, but how does a high personal intelligence manifest in one's life? What are the concrete or tangible manifestations?
Well, the... Most directly, it's the ability to solve problems in that area. So our gold standard for assessing personal intelligence are the questions on the scales of personal intelligence that we've constructed. But I think what you're asking is, okay, so if I'm walking around and I see somebody, they're not going to sit down and take a test for me.
Mm-hmm.
So how am I going to guess whether they have personal intelligence or not? And I think that it's easier to see if a person has it than doesn't have it, first of all, because you can see them, if you get the sense that they individuate you, that they recognize you for the individual that you are, and they recognize other people for the individuals that, that they are, and that they have a pretty good idea of how you're feeling about things, that's one, and thinking about things, that's one sign of one interpersonal sign of personal intelligence. Now, there are also what I'll call a number of low-grade indicators. That is, but that's what we deal with in personality. There are a number of clues which are not by no one by itself is determines it, but together they send a message. And those clues are the person is tends to be somewhat agreeable, tends to be somewhat open-minded, is comfortable with other people. Is interested in psychological processes, has a high, a somewhat higher than average verbal intelligence. But the fact of the matter is that you can have somebody who is disagreeable disagreeable anyway, and or of almost any personality who has high personal intelligence.
Now, does this have anything to do with IQ?
It does have something to do with it. It's earlier in the program, I was talking with you about the kind of broad intelligences that people were looking at in the late 80s, mm-hmm. 1980s. Things like verbal intelligence and perceptual organizational intelligence. And as you get out to, and spatial intelligence, and as you get out to personal intelligence, the relation, and those are all related to general intelligence, I should add, but none of them are, with the possible exception of verbal intelligence, they are not huge. No, let me see if I can. Sorry, I have to think about this.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I would say they are moderately to highly related to general intelligence. When you get out to personal intelligence, and for that matter, emotional intelligence, those are also related to general intelligence, but less so. So they are distant cousins. They're part of that same intelligence continuum.
Okay. So we're born with this then?
I'm assuming we don't have any genetic evidence yet because our tests are just constructed. I'm assuming. So I think a good starting place is to say, let's say 33, a third, let's say it's a third inherited, a third environmental, and a third some interaction between the two. And then we'll adjust those values as research tells us to.
Okay, so that means that if we're not born with naturally born with a high personal intelligence, that we can't acquire it from our environment or from nurturing.
Yes, I think we can learn a lot about personality, which helps us, which can help us make better represent other people, which is part of what we need to do is represent how other people act. And I've kind of been fooling around with the idea of this over the last few weeks as I've been thinking about this further. When you think about it, those other intelligences don't tell us anything about how people are going to behave. Verbal intelligence tells us how to communicate with other people, but by itself, it doesn't tell us anything about, well, what's my coworker going to do tomorrow? And ditto with perceptual organizational intelligence or spatial intelligence. They don't tell us anything about what our coworker is going to do tomorrow, but it helps us when we're at work to know what our coworker is going to do, and it surely helps us at home to know what our spouse or our children are going to do, are going to want to do. Over the next few days, not to mention over longer periods of time, so to be able to figure that out is very key to our well-being and to other people around us, to their well-being too. So most people, I think, have enough personal intelligence to function reasonably well in the area, but not everyone. And those of us who are in the middling to the higher areas can usually improve by learning more about how to do it.
Okay, we're going to take one more short break, and we're speaking with Professor John D. Mayer, renowned psychologist and author of Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality, and How It Shapes Our Lives. When we come back, we'll take your calls, so please stay with us. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. We are visiting with Professor John D. Mayer, also a renowned psychologist and the author of many things, but his latest work is Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality, and How It Shapes Our Lives. Let's take a call. We have Michael in Miami. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Topical Currents.
Thank you for taking my call. Good afternoon to you both. And, Professor, my question is there some kind of grouping of personalities? And if there is a grouping of personalities, what are the things that affect that, such as maybe the timing of someone's birth? I know if you look at the 12 tribes of Israel, for instance, each one of the tribes has a specific personality trait. I guess that sometime later on became the zodiac. So my question is, one, is there any kind of grouping of personalities? And if there is the timing of someone's birth a factor?
Yeah, great question. There are dozens of approaches to grouping personalities. Some of them are more out in the public, like astrological signs. Some of them are carried out by psychologists at universities. And typing personalities has not worked as well as researchers had hoped. And I think one of the reasons is that personalities are complicated. There are a lot of different dimensions along which personality varies. So right now there are not hugely popular typologies of personality that I'm aware of, at least in my own discipline of personality psychology. From time to time, researchers do take up, well, you know, are there differences among people born under different astrological signs? And there's not, once again, there's not compelling evidence that that's the case. I don't think anybody wants to ever say, you know, it's impossible or it couldn't be. But there's no compelling evidence of differences among people with different astrological signs.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And it seems to me a natural progression. For instance, Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing says there are nine areas of people activity. And with only nine people activities, then it seems to me a natural next step to say that wherever you are, or wherever group you're born into, your ideas, your feelings towards these nine people activities would be similar. Do you understand my point?
Yes, I don't quite know the people activities part, but I share with you, and I think a number of personalities, I don't want to speak for other personality psychologists, I share with you the aspiration that we can come up with some good groupings of people, because that would make our lives, as in trying to read one another, a lot easier.
Exactly.
Than to just say, well, there are these many different dimensions that we have to master. But I think that at the moment, at least, that's where our research tells us, is that a very useful way of understanding people is to say, okay, I'm going to go through a checklist, for example, of five dimensions about a person when I meet them. I'm going to see how outgoing they are, how conscientious they are, how agreeable they are, and so forth, and use that as our checklist rather than try to put them in a group.
I see. Thank you so much.
Okay, Michael. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Before the break, Jack, you said if we can anticipate our others' behaviors, that it helps. Like if a coworker, we can anticipate what they're going to do based on, you know, knowing ourselves and knowing them, or a spouse. Now, I can see, I'm just going to stick with the coworker for a minute. What if
Sure.
the coworker is a negative person? And whenever you encounter this coworker, you feel a cloud, you know, of negativity. So being able to anticipate that, how can having a high personal intelligence how does it necessarily make you happier? Perhaps it makes you not as happy.
Well, my take on that is you're going to face that coworker one way or the other, whether
right.
you're high or low. Now, if I'm low, I may not recognize that the person is sort of has that negative cloud above their head. And that's going to make it harder to interpret what that person says to me. But if I'm higher in personal intelligence, I'm going to say, here's my colleague who's can be rather negative. In fact, seems to either prefer it or just is that way. So I'm going to do certain things with that. I might ask, for example, well, why is that person a little bit more negative? And over time, I might discover that. But on an immediate operating basis, I'm going to say to myself, if they're criticizing me, for example, well, okay, this is a person who is often negative. Now, I'm not going to disregard what they say, because the value of negative people, and I think that almost every personality style has its adaptive and useful values. The advantage of a negative person is they may tell me things which other people might not be willing to tell me. So I'm going to listen to what the person has to say, but I'm also not going to necessarily take it too seriously if, for example, they're the only one who thinks that, that my ideas are just unhelpful.
Okay, we want to talk to Claudia. Claudia is in Pembroke Pines. Welcome, Claudia.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with how does one compare, what are the similarities and difference between personal intelligence and emotional intelligence? And then the next follow-up question is, how does one bridge the gap between knowing thyself and bridging the gap between what other perceives of oneself and what we truly know of oneself? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you. So think of personal intelligence as a dramatic broadening of emotional intelligence. Whereas emotional intelligence concerns reasoning about emotions specifically, personal intelligence involves reasoning not only about emotions, but also placing them together with motivations, a person's preferred traits or styles of behaving and expressing themselves, and a person's self-control. So personal intelligence is in many respects the more powerful theory, at least as I see it, a broadening of the theory. Now, in the second part of your question, you asked whether how we know the difference, or how we sort of put together self-knowledge, knowledge about that other people hold of us, and maybe our reputation, if I understand and remember that correctly.
Is that correct, Claudia?
Part of it is reputation, but the other part of it is the collective knowledge of how others perceive me mm-hmm. versus my own understanding of myself.
Okay. Right. So let's start there, because that's such a great question. There are some places, and this is where the intelligence part comes in. Let's say that I feel, today is Monday, and I'm feeling kind of blue today, let's say, and everybody else thinks that I'm really cheerful. Well, in this case, I have the upper hand because I know what I'm feeling inside, and I know that people can't necessarily read emotions well of other people, particularly if they're trying to cover those up. If I'm feeling sad inside and other people think that I'm happy, I'm going to go with my own feeling for that because I know how I'm feeling at that particular point in time. On the other hand, if I think that I've come up with a creative new solution to something at work and all of my colleagues say, oh, no, that's really silly and it won't work for reasons A, B, C, and D, then I might be more inclined to take that collective response seriously because they are evaluating, they have as much access to the idea that I've just generated as I do. And so unless I have a reason to believe that they're trying to undermine me in some way, I might have to go with them and say, you know, their knowledge of me may be better, or at least of my idea, may be more accurate than my own. And in fact, their estimate of my skill level may be more accurate than my own.
Okay, Claudia?
That's great. And how does one level of consciousness, like Clara Graves' spiral dynamics, would come into increasing personal intelligence?
I'm sorry. Did you? If you said Clara Graves, I'm not sure I'm familiar with her work. Is there another way to ask the question, perhaps? Or can you tell me more about it?
Sure. One's the collective level of consciousness, as referred to in spiral dynamics, and which is basically goes back to how one perceives the world and oneself.
Uh-huh.
And does that have any effect on personal intelligence?
Okay. Well, like I said, I'm not so familiar with it specifically, but given your description, one really interesting thing is, well, how we know that we can alter our consciousness by focusing on different things, by meditating, and by engaging in other similar practices. So, how does that affect personal intelligence? I don't know yet. It's a really interesting question.
Mm. Well, we have also an emailer. Robin has 2 points. I don't know if we have time for both of them. One is he said he's heard nothing regarding other animals. We're not the only species with individual personalities who relate with others.
Yes, and that's very interesting. We do know, for example, that certain members of the great ape species also watch one another for one another's behaviors. They register who is generous and who is stingy. And make personality judgments on that basis.
He also says, which I really find interesting, maybe you could comment on, I find most psychology used to rationalize one's own failure or success. And there's a lot in the book about defense mechanisms and rationalizations. Do you want to comment on that?
Yes. I think that, first of all, I think that There is an ongoing debate, which I discuss in the introduction to the book, actually, as to, okay, so how much responsibility should we take for ourselves and how much responsibility is our situation and our upbringing and stuff like that. And I don't want to deny those things are tremendously important. And personalities, as we've already discussed, are dependent on situations tremendously. So I think that part of personal intelligence is, in fact, knowing the limits of personality. And the limits of personality are substantial. We all grow up in a culture and an environment and so forth that affects us deeply.
We only have, 15 seconds for you to answer from Phil. How does your research apply to people with developmental disabilities? Can you answer that quickly, as in Down syndrome?
I don't know specifically, but I would say that what it affects is that for everybody, it makes sense to give scales that go beyond the traditional intelligences because there are more intelligences and more means of problem solving that people have that I believe it's important for us to recognize to be fair to people.
Well, we want to thank you, Professor John D. Mayer from the University of New Hampshire, professor of psychology and renowned psychologist. And his latest book is Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives.
Thank you. It's been delightful to be here.
And we'll also have links to your book, and also you have personalintelligence.info for more information about the book. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you.
And it's been a pleasure. Thank you, and regards to your listeners.
Thank you. That wraps up Monday's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. Our producer's Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. More information at WLRN.org and our Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program features an interview with Ariel Gonzalez and author Gary Steingart. Bonnie Berman, hoping you enjoy your Monday. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.